Welcome to The Final Word, a Bible teaching ministry with pastor, teacher, and author Jim Andrews. The Final Word is grounded on the invincible conviction that what the Bible teaches, God teaches. And that is the last word. On this program, truth still matters. The Bible is in, Babel is out. The Final Word is funded by listeners like you. Should you want to partner with us or want other information about the program, please go to our website at thefinalwordradio.com. There you'll find archives so you can listen to any program you may have missed. Visit us on our social media platforms at The Final Word Radio and write us a note. We love hearing from our listeners. We'll provide other contact information at the end of the program, so have your pen ready. And now Jim Andrews continues his current study of God's Word.
Good day, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you for joining us again on The Final Word. Before I launch today's exposition, I want to make our listening audience aware of not only the books that I have authored, but some articles that I have written that you might be interested in, and tell you how to access them. Over the years, I have done a good deal of writing, as time allows, to prepare resources that I think should be helpful to my congregation and also helpful to you, our listeners. If you will go to jimandrewsbooks.com, that's one word, jimandrewsbooks.com, you will find there information describing the books I have authored, one of them co-authored with my daughter. On top of that, on the same website, you'll see a tab that says Articles. If you will open that with your cursor, you will discover there are some articles that I've produced over the years that you may find interesting and helpful. For example, one of the most recent articles was my take on the demise of the culture wars and where I think we ought to go from here. Another article that appeared several years ago in a journal for biblical manhood and womanhood is entitled Boundaries Without Bonds. Another is a rebuttal of a tract that appeared several years back. The author attempted cleverly, but as I will show unsuccessfully, to persuade us that the Scriptures do not condemn homosexual practice after all. That has all been a misunderstanding. I'm not a regular blogger, but when sometimes things pop up on my radar that I feel I would like to address in a thoughtful way, I will sometimes produce a longer article like some of these. We continue our exposition of 2 Samuel. We're closing in on the end of this book. We're in that section, which is somewhat awkwardly called the appendix of the book. We come now to 2 Samuel chapter 23. We first encounter the last song of David, his sign-off, with a vision to the future, a vision which is to be realized in his greater descendant, Jesus Christ. David himself is the type of the Messiah who is to come. Now these are the last words of David. David, the son of Jesse, declares, and the man who was raised on high declares, the anointed of the God of Jacob and the sweet psalmist of Israel. He says, the Spirit of the Lord spoke by me, and his word was on my tongue. The God of Israel said, the rock of Israel spoke to me. All this is Hebrew parallelism, saying the same thing basically in couplets. He who rules over men righteously, he who rules in the fear of God, is as the light of the morning when the sun rises, a morning without clouds, when the tender grass springs out of the earth through sunshine after rain. Truly, is not my house so with God? For he has made an everlasting covenant with me, ordered in all things and secured. For all my salvation and all my desire, will he not indeed make it grow? But the worthless, every one of them will be thrust away like thorns, because they cannot be taken in hand. But the man who touches them must be armed with iron and a shaft of spear, and they will be completely burned with fire in their place. David acknowledges that God has raised him up, not he by his own endowments. Those people whom the Lord lifts up to prominent or powerful places, unlike David, I have noted, seem to grow more full of themselves as time marches on. They seem to grow in their sense of self-importance and become more likely to ascribe their success, at least in part, to their own intrinsic merits and accomplishments. It's a lot easier, I believe, to acknowledge God on the front end of a soaring career than on the latter end, when the successful and prosperous tend to grow proud. In verse 3, you will note that David claims divine inspiration or the spirit of prophecy for his words. The God of Israel said, the rock of Israel spoke to me. Hence, what he wrote in his psalms or songs reliably expressed the thoughts of God. content that the Spirit put in David's mind and at the end of his pen anticipates the rule of David's greater son, that is, the ideal ruler of God. It anticipates one whose kingdom will never end. His reign will be such that it is like the precious morning light scattering the darkness. His reign will be such that it's like the sunshine after a rain, refreshing the tender grass. It's a picture here in verse 4 of refreshment to the earth, a time of light and repose, when at last all is right with the world. In verse 5, he tells us that that is a metaphor of the way it is in the plan of God for the house of David. The house of David is sovereignly ordered. It's secure in its foundations. It rests on an enduring covenant that God made with David. And it issues in, David says, my salvation and all my desire. In other words, history, David says, has a happy ending for the people of God, for David. But in verse 6, but for now, the earth suffers the burden of the worthless. The worthless are those like a tangle of growths of briars and thorns. They pierce the hands of any who lay hold of them, but they are not forever. They're hopeless for every good purpose. These are a burden and a curse to the earth. But in his time, God will send his king, David's greater son, to subdue them and to burn them up with everlasting fire. They will be completely burned with fire in their place, and I would add, in their day. Great men are not great alone. In the providence of God, they are surrounded by others who help them. And so it was with David. Now, in verses 8 through 39, we have a catalog that memorializes the names and some of the exploits of the mighty men and elite soldiers, the special forces, who surrounded David during the king's reign and battles with the enemies of Israel, that is to say, the enemies of God. For those who hate the people of God, remember, also hate the God of the people. So it has always been. Those who hate the church of God in our world today hate the God of the church. That equation is always reliable. What we have in verses 8 through 39 of chapter 23 is a record of what was for Israel the greatest generation, the generation of David. By analogy, this roster of heroes would be something like a roll call of the great generals and the most heroic soldiers who've led our nation to victory over its enemies during the two great world wars. I won't attempt to read all these names. It would just get excruciatingly boring, but we must understand the message. There are two groups of three mighty men, and their specific exploits are described in verses 8 through 12 and 13 through 23. What you have here in verse 8 through the end of chapter 23 is a kind of military hall of fame. Years ago, I read somewhere a history authority make a comment relative to the four impressive generals who succeeded Alexander the Great. And that historian made this comment, that one measure of the greatness of Alexander is the quality of the men who devotedly followed Alexander the Great's command. Well, certainly it is a comment on the military prowess of David as a warrior, that such mighty men as these were steadfast and devoted to him throughout his career. Such loyalty is here rewarded by the narrator with a formal citation of their names and some of their remarkable exploits for the historical record. So this is a kind of literary monument to their memory and contribution to the life of the nation Israel. In a way, the record is placed there under the influence of the Spirit of God, for it is a type and it's a testimony to the fact that all those who are loyal to Christ, David's greater son, will likewise never be forgotten, but honored in heaven itself. Those who bear his cross will also share his crown, just as these who bore the sufferings of David also, in the end, shared in the glory of David. Some of these and these lists, you will note, were Gentiles. At some point, some of these came over to David. They were accepted as equals in his ranks. That, I believe, is a kind of harbinger of the Gentiles coming over to Christ, David's greater son, when the gospel went out to them. The overarching lesson here is that God remembers and he honors those who fight the battles of the Lord. Now that brings us to the last chapter, chapter 24. Now this narrative is full of puzzles. As one reads the narrative, several questions quickly force themselves on our attention and beg for an answer. Let me just read it. Now again, the anger of the Lord burned against Israel. You recall earlier, the anger of the Lord had burned when they had this great drought. Well, here again, the anger of the Lord burned against Israel, and the anger of the Lord incited David against them to say, "Go, number Israel and Judah." And the king said to Joab, the commander of the army who was with him, "Go about now through all the tribes of Israel, from Dan to Beersheba, that is, from north to south, and register the people, that I may know the number of them." Joab said to the king, "Now, may the Lord your God add to the people 100 times as many as they are, while the eyes of my lord the king still see. But why does my lord the king delight in this thing?" Joab sensed there was just something off base about it. Nevertheless, the king's word prevailed against Joab and against the commanders of the army. So Joab and the commanders of the army, they went out from the presence of the king to register to take a census of the people of Israel. And then the next verses describe all of their movements. And Joab, verse 9, gave the number of the registration of the people to the king, and there were in Israel 800,000 valiant men who drew the sword, and the men of Judah were 500,000 men. But in verse 10, we read that David's heart troubled him after he had numbered the people. So David said to the Lord, "I have sinned greatly in what I have done. But now, Lord, please take away the iniquity of thy servant, for I have acted very foolishly." And he will have a visit by the prophet immediately after that. Now, there's some big questions in this text. The first is, obviously, what is the big deal about taking a census? It seems, on the face of it, like a perfectly sensible administrative procedure, especially in terms of military preparedness and tax administration. In fact, under Moses, the Lord directed a census to be taken on 2 occasions, in Numbers 1 and Numbers 26. So one's bound to ask, what is the sin here? Whatever it was, it is ironic that David, whose heart was normally finely calibrated to the heart of God, was initially blind to his transgression, and that Joab, his military chief of staff, who was often morally callous and spiritually dense, Joab, it was, who saw in it something that he discountenanced and found abhorrent. That's the first question. The second obvious question is this. If the Lord had a beef with Israel, the nation, why was it necessary to incriminate David to lacerate his subjects in judgment? And thirdly, how do we explain the fact that the instigation of David's sin here in 2 Samuel 24 is attributed to the Lord himself, but in 1 Chronicles 21:1 attributed to satanic influence? On its face, that seems contradictory, doesn't it? And if God caused David to sin, it seems to make God the author of evil. And that's contrary to what the rest of the Bible teaches about the character of God. So we've got some important questions there that we need to answer. So let's start first with the offense of David. What was it? Took a census. Doesn't seem to be anything that should be repugnant in the eyes of God, but yet it was. As we indicated earlier, the offense here is not taking the military census per se, but it's in the circumstances attended to it. Some things are not wrong in themselves, but they may become very wrong by abuse or misapplication. For example, there's nothing legally, spiritually, or morally wrong about making a profit on a business transaction. Yet, as we all know from some of the corporate shenanigans exposed to the public from time to time, profits may be immorally excessive or even illegal in certain circumstances. Another example, to marry is not wrong in itself. And in fact, it's most often a good thing. However, to marry an inappropriate or illegitimate partner is an abomination in the sight of God. Well, this census was, and I'm quoting, a general mustering for a military statistical purpose. Still quoting, David wished to know the military force of the whole people. That was not evil in itself. But, quoting Lang, in his response, Joab perceives that David's purpose was to please and flatter himself with the exhibition of the imposing military strength of his people. So by inference, we discern David's error. From David's pigheadedness, from the military role of the census, from the fact that it was a time of relative peace and quiet in David's last years, we infer from Joab's protest, all of that leads us to join other biblical scholars in the conclusion that David's motive in forcing this census over top Joab's strenuous objection was just self-serving and prideful. David was like a rich man counting his money. David was congratulating himself on his business savvy. In trying to statistically measure the greatness of his military power, In this instance, David was in effect misplacing the credit for his military achievements. And in effect, he was deflecting the glory that belonged to God alone to himself. Let me give you an analogy. It would be much like a pastor at the end of a long and successful tenure, where his church had grown from a small, insignificant flock meeting in a home to a sprawling megachurch of many thousands. The pastor now stands back and he surveys his massive physical plant. He proudly counts his flock and tells all who would listen about his big staff and his staggering annual budget, and then saying, as one pastor I heard about did, "My wife and I have built this church up to this." Folks, God will share his glory with no man. Long, unfettered success is a great danger. It can turn the head and it can twist the mind of the best of men. And it can even, as we see, seduce one like David to prideful excess and rob God of credit for God's achievements that belong to him alone. David was a great and good man, but he was not a perfect man. And every once in a while he let his slip show. The normally spiritually callow and morally callous Joab, the commander of the army, apparently saw right through it, and he discountenanced this census to David's face. Had it been earlier in David's reign, David would have been a moral compass for Joab rather than the other way around. It should have warned David of his error when Joab had to be David's conscience. When the fox has to protect the hens from the chicken farmer, things are really on their head. I quote, "The punishment that followed the attempt to take this census shows that it was made in proud self-feeling outside the will of the Lord, Israel's true king, and for a self-serving end that did not accord with the aims and the purposes of the Lord." David, then, has his eye for the moment on his own strength and power, and he briefly lost sight of the one to whom he owed his and his nation's elevation. In this, David revealed for all of his spiritual greatness his human susceptibility to all the temptations of the flesh and the downward moral pull of what we call success and power. Kyle and Dalich make a comment, "The true kernel of David's sin was to be found, no doubt, in self-exaltation, inasmuch as he sought for the strength and glory of the kingdom in the number of people and their readiness for war. God determined to punish him and Israel by reducing their number, either by famine, war, or pestilence." Okay, that was David's sin, but what's it have to do with Israel? Because God was angry at Israel, we see. And all of this was part of the same equation. What grievance did the Lord have with Israel as a whole that caused pain aimed at David to land on the people also? Well, here's the answer, I think. What the Lord saw peeking its ugly head, a spirit of self-centered national pride rather than pride strictly in the Lord himself and David, their king and representative, the Lord saw, we can presume, in greater measure and grosser form in the people themselves. This is a classic example of that phenomenon we talked about two or three studies ago, known as corporate solidarity. In this case, shared guilt between the people themselves and the royal representative. Let me give a couple of illustrations. How often are we reminded by pundits and political observers that those who govern us at any given time generally reflect the attitudes and mores of those they govern? If our politicians are generally corrupt, it is because their constituents are too. I think San Francisco is a classic example of that truth. I think Portland, Oregon, where we live, is a classic example of that truth. Hitler rose to power because of his militaristic spirit and racial prejudices, those connected to such a great degree with those of his nation. Without those broadly based sympathies, Hitler could never have come to power, and when he did, he could never have stayed in power as long as he did. He and his Nazi party, therefore, mirrored, in some measure, the majority of the German people. There is no escaping that, and one reading of Michael Burley's thick tome, The History of the Third Reich, will illustrate the justice of that conclusion. So there is corporate solidarity in this sin. So the pride of their king was mirrored to the grosser pride in God's people. How so? Whenever people rebel against God's arrangements, the taproot of their unbelief is always prideful self-sufficiency. David was their God-appointed monarch. When a great many of them, especially tribes other than Judah, defected from David and went over to David's son, Absalom, when Absalom attempted to overthrow his father and seat himself on the throne of Israel, Absalom briefly succeeded, only to die in trying to capture David and put him to death. Only then did the rebels bring David back to the throne, but not all of them. Some of them then joined another renegade from the tribe of Benjamin, an outlaw by the name of Sheba. Sheba briefly threatened to do more damage than Absalom. These insurrections, these vomitings, were put down, but the Lord had not forgotten the prideful, independent spirit behind them. And now the Lord was about to use this outrageous sin of David as a platform from which to launch retribution. Their spiritual condition was far more off the charts than David's, but David's sin was the trigger that set judgment in motion. The ways of the Lord are complex, and, of course, in many ways, past understanding. So the next question is, who was really responsible for inciting David to this sin? Was it God or Satan? 2 Samuel 24 says God. 1 Chronicles 21 says Satan. Well, rightly understood, it was both. To humble David's excessive pride and self-vaunting spirit, the Lord sovereignly unleashed Satan, exactly as he did in the case of Job, but this time on David. The Lord turned Satan loose. It was a sovereign action, and he let him camp out on this ledge of ungodly pride in David's heart. And like a prompter, Satan played on David's kingly pride. He enticed him to exult in his successes. He prompted David in his devilish way to flatter himself by measuring his military power on his own authority. He helped David forget that the Lord was the real king of Israel. It was dominated by the conviction of the sovereignty of God in all human affairs and transactions. Those Old Testament writers in particular often describe human events in a way that just bypasses secondary instruments and attributes actions to the ultimate sovereign director of all events. In the Hebrew way of thinking, whatever God permits, he commits. Or, as I would put it, in the Old Testament way of seeing things, whatever God controls, he causes. Or better yet, whatever outcomes God superintends indirectly, he is seen as sending directly. We have some analogy to that way of thinking yet today. In our national politics, the President of the United States is often praised or accused of political actions taken by his subordinates. Subordinates who act as if he himself explicitly directed them when in fact he only permitted, empowered, or enabled others under him to do whatever it is for which he receives credit or blame. Well, so it is, since God ultimately, providentially controls the movements of men and occurrence of history. God, from the Old Testament perspective, can be viewed in this sense as having brought them about. As one scholar put it, the Hebrews sometimes were not very concerned with nuances such as sorting out secondary causes from the primary controller or director of things. Under the concept of divine providence, everything that happens may in some way be attributed to a sovereign superintendent. So this error of David is attributed to God in the sense that the sovereign license of God set in motion or unleashed the secondary influence, Satan, that surfaced this prideful excess in the heart of David. An illustration of this looking past a secondary instrument to the sovereign source of outcome in 1 Chronicles chapter 10, verse 14. The Lord is said to have killed Saul, the first king of Israel. Actually, Saul died on Mount Gilboa at the hands of the Philistines. It was not a direct divine execution. So Saul died, we read, for his trespass which he committed against the Lord because of the word of the Lord which Saul did not keep. Also, he asked counsel of a medium, making direct inquiry of it, and did not inquire of the Lord. Therefore he, the Lord, killed him, and turned the kingdom to David, the son of Jesse. Well, the secondary instruments of his death were the Philistines in his own hand. Had Saul lived in our times and his death been reported on CNN, the news would have cited him as the prominent casualty of war and attributed his death to hostile arms, assisted by his own hands. And so here it is in the case of David. Well, friends, thank you for joining us on The Final Word. God bless you and have a wonderful day.
The Final Word is a listener-supported ministry. Should you want to partner with us or want other information about this program, please visit our website at thefinalwordradio.com. Our postal address is The Final Word, 4565 Carmen Drive, Lake Oswego, Oregon, 97035. Our email address is info@thefinalwordradio.com. Our phone number is 503-699-9840. If this program has ministered to you, tell a friend about it. We do solicit your prayers for God's hand upon this outreach.